We do not have a quorum, so we will not call the meeting officially to order, but we are going to get started. I am going to ask Representative Barrett to begin presenting his bill. This is an informational hearing. We will not be acting on the bill. I would ask testifiers to keep testimony to roughly 2 minutes apiece, mainly because we have a number of other committees meeting at the same time and need to be nimble, as I like to say, right around this time. But if you can keep your testimony brief and to the point, that will be helpful. Representative Barrett, welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your presentation.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss House File 2797 in this informational hearing. I want to thank you personally, Chair Gottwald, for allowing this opportunity after deadline, and I also want to thank Representative Lohmer for her particular support in allowing this bill to be heard today. Regarding some work on the bill last night, I couldn't help but see the irony in this informational hearing, as the subject of the bill is all about information. And mainly, if a hospital has a futility policy, they are required, should they be required to share it with their patients at the appropriate time. The bill is a pretty straightforward bill, and if you don't mind, I'll read it to y'all. It's a bill for an act relating to health requiring disclosure of certain hospital futility policies. And Section 1, a hospital licensed under Sections 144.5 through 144.56 then adopts or implements a futility policy that applies to treatment of any child from birth to 18 years of age must disclose the futility policy to the parents of the children treated at the hospital and must file a copy of the hospital futility policy with the Commissioner of Health. For the purposes of this section, a futility policy is any policy, whether written or otherwise, that encourages hospital employees or other medical professionals who provide care to patients at the hospital to withhold or discontinue treatment for a patient on the grounds of medical futility when withholding or discontinuing treatment would result in financial benefit to the hospital. Pretty simple bill. This is an informational hearing is about information and sharing that information with moms and dads who have a small child who is in the hospital who is undergoing life-saving treatment. And so with that, Mr. Chair, we have a number of people who would like to testify today. And rather than go on too much, I'd like the opportunity for them to share their story in front of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Barrett. Our first testifier is Mary Collette. Ms. Collette, could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak before the committee. My name is Mary Collette, and I'm a resident of Maple Grove.
Thank you. May we proceed?
I am a mother of 11 children, the youngest of which, Peter, had a condition known as trisomy 18. I want to speak in support of House File 2797 and to tell you my story, because I believe it is important for you to know as you consider the need for this legislation. When I was 19 weeks pregnant, an ultrasound revealed markers for a condition called trisomy 18. We were offered an amnio, which we refused because we didn't want to risk hurting our baby. We were told we would have more choices if we knew for sure. We said we'd never abort our baby, but would love him no matter what he had. We named him Peter. We were told there were no survivors beyond 2 weeks with trisomy 18, that most people aborted babies like this. At 33 weeks, I had an emergency C-section. Peter weighed 3 pounds and 2 ounces. Peter was given excellent care until day 2 of his life, when a fish test revealed he did have trisomy 18. At that time, it was recommended to us that we stop all treatment, wrap him up in a blanket, and let him die. We were told he would leave a life of terrible pain and suffering, and would never know us or respond to us. My daughter went on the internet and found many children living with this, some in their 20s and 30s. When I asked the doctor why he had lied to me, he said, "Well, how these children do largely depends on the choices their parents make for them." I responded, "How can parents make choices when they don't receive accurate information?" He then said, "Well, we have to think about resources, and you know, Peter will never be able to contribute to society and will be a horrible burden to your family." I started to cry because I knew resources meant money, and it hurt so badly to have a doctor tell me my son wasn't worthy of the need of treatment to help him live. Another woman, doctor who I'd never met until after Peter was born, came into my hospital room and said she wanted to talk to me as a mother, not as a doctor. She said that if I wanted to be a good mother to my other children, I had to let Peter go because he would be a burden to our whole family and it was not fair to them. I could do nothing but cry. We were told our son's heart defect was fatal. Something told me the doctor was not telling the truth. So we made our own appointment with a pediatric cardiologist who shook his head and said Peter's heart was stable and functional, but he did need a minor surgery called a PDA ligation. The doctor at the hospital told us that Peter was not a candidate for the surgery that was described to us as open heart surgery. We were asked why we'd want to put our son through that. It was not open heart surgery, but a minor procedure to close a blood vessel. This is just a small example of the incomplete, inaccurate information and outright lies we received. We were pressured over and over to sign a DNR. We were even told we could not receive home care visits from a nurse unless we signed a DNR. I called the director of the home care nursing program and asked her if this was true. She was flabbergasted and told us this was not their policy, nor had it ever been their policy. When I confronted the doctor about that, she said, "Well, they must have changed their policy," to which I responded, "No, it has never been their policy." We were very concerned about our son's welfare. It was very hard leaving him at the hospital knowing they felt as they did. We called the head doctor of the NICU at the University of Minnesota for a second opinion and shared our concerns. When the doctor at the hospital Peter was staying at found out, she was very angry. The next day, she said we had two choices. We could take Peter home or we could transfer him to Children's. She already called and they had a bed ready for him. She said that we had to leave her hospital. We decided to take Peter home. He only weighed 3 pounds, 11 ounces. He thrived on all the love and attention and grew and did many things we were told he would never do, like drink from a bottle and eat by mouth. He knew us and loved us, and we loved him. He was the happiest, sweetest little boy, who was everyone's favorite. He was never, ever a burden. Only a joy and a blessing. He made us all better. And he taught us so much about love and compassion for others. He was the best of us. Peter died at Children's Hospital in Minneapolis at the age of 6 and a half after having his appendix removed. I have to wonder if he was a victim of their hospital's futility care policy. I've talked to many other families who also have children with disabilities that have similar concerns and stories to share. By having this policy, doctors and hospitals are making a value judgment about children that only parents have the right to make. You may hear from the hospitals that they rarely use this policy. That is a very personal and sensitive matter. That it is a very personal and sensitive matter for parents to go through, and how they think it is burdensome to parents to have to present this to them upon admittance. They may call my situation a great tragedy, but if they truly believe that, they would support this bill and my right as a parent to know about this policy before I bring my child to their hospital. The tragedy is that parents have to advocate for their children in what should be a trusting doctor-patient relationship, with no knowledge that the doctors they are supposed to trust have policies that favor and encourage death. Hospitals don't want to publicize that they have these policies because they fear that parents might take their children elsewhere. They say these policies are not driven by money. But I have to ask, by what are they driven? Ideology? The bottom line is parents have a right to know, and that is what this bill accomplishes. In conclusion, I just want to say this bill simply gives parents the right to know if a hospital has a futility policy and what it is. It provides a level of consumer protection and healthcare choice. Parents shouldn't carry the burden of fear and stress over the policies of the hospital, especially during a medical crisis. They have a right to know before they bring their child, disabled or not, to that hospital. And they have a right, both legally and naturally, to be the decision makers of their child's health care. Please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Collette. I'm going to take a moment here and call our meeting officially to order since we have a quorum. And I'll allow this to be freelanced. Who wants to move the minutes? Anybody?
So move.
Otherwise, I'll pick somebody. I think Representative Lohmer had her hand up first. So Representative Lohmer moves the minutes of March 21st, 2012. Any questions, comments? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Just a reminder to our testifiers, too, appreciate this testimony. We know this is a very emotional bill. This is a very serious issue. But we're trying to keep our testimony down to about 2 minutes. If you can help us with that, because there are many other committees going on right now. Next up, we have Gretchen Thibault. Gretchen, welcome to the committee. Please state your full name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gretchen Thibault, and I'm a resident of Shoreview. I'm the mother of several children, two of whom have Down syndrome, and I will speak fast. The two with Down syndrome are 4 and 5 years old. We adopted them because of our love for people with Down syndrome and the gift that we see in them. They are the love and the joy of all of our lives. Before having my children, I was a high-risk obstetrics nurse and a newborn nurse. I worked at both the University of Minnesota and Abbott Northwestern Hospital. Because of my background, I occasionally find myself as an advocate for children with special needs who have been patients at local hospitals as well as out of state. I would like to emphasize several points that are critical regarding this futility policies. Excuse me, Mary made me cry. Number one, hospitals should be required to make any futility of care policy public and easily available online. Number two, futility policies should not refer to the futility of the patient as a person. Rather, it should only apply to medical care that will cause more harm than good if it were implemented or continued. Number three, if the futility policy is being applied to a patient, the patient and his or her family should be made aware that the hospital or its medical staff intends to apply the policy to the patient so that the patient's family can be informed and choose to seek care elsewhere. As a nurse, a friend, as an advocate, I have witnessed situations where a child is very much living, yet the physician or perhaps board have unilaterally decided that their life is not valuable enough to receive even simple medical care, even though the care is being paid for, perhaps with their own funds and through their insurance company. I also witnessed a situation where the hospital was convincing a young family that their daughter had no options available to correct her partially paralyzed diaphragm. In my research, I found a procedure that was said to be standard treatment that should be, quote, offered to every child with this condition. When the information was presented to the doctor, they admitted that it was an option but didn't think that this particular child should have it done. One doctor said of the same patient, sure, we can fix the heart, we can fix the diaphragm, but what's the point? We can't fix her brain. This child had a trisomy. A nurse said to me, why would you encourage these parents to keep this child alive when she will go home to these uneducated, young, poor parents? I couldn't believe she said it to me. These parents were told that the best thing that they could do was to take their child home and give her morphine to keep her comfortable. This is a case where the medical care would not have been futile. However, the hospital had apparently decided that the patient was futile and not worthy of living. My two sons have very different abilities. My first son with Down syndrome, Ricky, was adopted at birth, and he's been given the world in terms of medical care, therapies, early education, and family life, and he's doing amazing. He's vibrant in every way. You can see his picture. The other lived for his first 3 years in a crib in an Eastern European orphanage. He was deemed unfit to be in Eastern European society. He was locked away, as are all children with disabilities in this post-communist area. His life is every bit as precious to us as our other son, despite his needs and the level in which he functions. To think that my son, who was once a victim of neglect, could possibly have his life deemed futile again without me ever even knowing is quite simply incomprehensible. As a mother and as a consumer, I should be able to make a choice that is in the best interest of my child as to where he will receive the best care. Until futility care policies are made public and easily accessible, I will not be able to make informed health care decisions for my sweet children. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grinhagen.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chair. When did these, to the testifier, if you're aware, when did these futility policies start to be implemented? Do you know?
Ms. Thibault.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I don't have any knowledge of that. The information is not out there. I mean, futility care policies, medical futility, have been out for, I mean, I'm looking at articles that go back, you know, over 10 years ago. But these aren't made public, so there's really no way for me to know where at any which hospital that I've been, where they, when they've been enacted.
Representative Barrett.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen. The issue of futility has been around for, dare I say, hundreds, if not thousands of years, in that at some point in someone's life, a doctor or someone in a medical situation decides that someone will be dying. And so the issue has been there for a long, long time. Question here is whether those policies should be made public and whether patients and their moms and dads can be notified about that prior to any life-saving efforts being rescinded.
Perhaps, Ms. Krinke, would you be able to comment on that? How long have hospitals had futility policies in place? I mean, is this something that's gone on for decades, or is it a more recent? Why don't you come to the testifying table if you want? And then Representative Grinhagen, I've noted you want to make a follow-up, so. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Krinke.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. We have today the last speaker on the agenda, who is a chaplain with Gillette Children's Hospital, who was involved with the policies and the procedures that really started sort of the model of this care. And so I'd prefer to defer to her. She's an expert in the field who does this every day. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Representative Grinhagen? Did you have a follow-up?
I'd like to hear the testimony from the person she referred to. Is she next?
We've got three more testifiers.
Okay.
So perhaps we could wait until
until she comes.
Very good. Okay, our next testifier is Diane Sterling. Ms. Sterling, welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Please state your full name for the record and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Okay, my name is Diane Sterling. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak before the committee today. I want to speak in support of Senate File HF 2797 and tell you my story.
I'm sorry. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. When I was about 20 weeks pregnant, an ultrasound revealed markers for a condition called trisomy 18. One of these markers was clenched fists. We were told she would never be able to open and close her hands or grasp anything. Sarah is now 6 years old and continues to grasp her toys, to play with them, and use her hands productively. We were told that 50% of these children don't survive past their first week of life, 90% don't live past 1 year. We were told that some doctors down in the cities could deliver her early. They said they couldn't do it at this particular hospital because they were a Catholic hospital. I had become an active home birth mother with my last four children and asked if they meant an abortion. I was told that they didn't use that type of terminology anymore. It was rather harsh, but called it deliver early instead. I was shocked that a hospital would recommend such a thing. My husband and I were forced to talk with genetic counselors. They tried to pressure both of us to abort her. They said she wouldn't survive being born anyway, would probably die in the womb. If she was born alive, that she would never know us, be able to do anything, and would be a huge burden to our family. We then started trying to educate ourselves to help Sarah before she arrived. My husband and I visited several hospitals. We were told by one hospital, gynecologist at North Memorial, and I quote, "We only have so many nurses on our staff, and they're paid to take care of the healthy, thriving babies first before they're going to bother tube feeding your baby." I responded, what are you telling us, that you're going to place her in a corner and let her die? The gynecologist then said, I'm just telling you like it is. Don't think that you're going to have her here. My husband told the doctor, well, we wouldn't think of it. We mentioned a few other hospitals that we were looking at to him, and he said they wouldn't take us either. He said that no one would help us and that we would have to take her and have her at home. We were told that we could not get a referral for heart surgery to repair her heart, even though normal children were allowed this service and it was a common heart repair. The gynecologist stated that he wouldn't provide me with a referral to a heart specialist because it wasn't in his good conscience to do so. He said it wasn't worth fixing her heart because she was going to die anyway. We were pressured not to put her through this pain and suffering. We fortunately found a cardiologist that was willing to help. We were told by him and other doctors that most of these children die because of lack of care provided to them. He said we would need to fight for her to be her advocate. We were warned that the hospitals would try to kill her and described many things to watch out for. We were warned to never leave her side while at any hospital because she would end up dead. One doctor even walked me out to my car to talk with me because he didn't believe it was safe to talk within the hospital walls. I was shocked to have a heart specialist walk me to my car. After Sarah was born, she became sick with a hospital-borne infection within her second month of life that required IV antibiotics. We were told we should just let her die because she was to die from something and that it might as well be a blood infection. My husband asked, isn't the infection treatable? The doctor said, yes, but I don't recommend treating it. We asked him, if it was his child without Sarah's condition or cancer or disease or any mental issue, what would he do? He said, of course I would treat her with IV antibiotics right away. We said, we want this for Sarah then. We want her treated like any normal child. We also wanted to get a G-tube placed in her stomach because Sarah was too small to nurse effectively. We were warned beforehand that a feeding tube in the nose was not safe due to the high incidence of incorrect placement and not to leave the hospital without a G-tube. The doctor in charge told my husband that he would see to it that Sarah would never receive a G-tube. We went home without one because we didn't know how to fight the system that blatantly was against our daughter. After Sarah's heart surgery, she came home for about 2 weeks. She then was brought to our local hospital because she aspirated food into her lungs due to a home nurse placing the feeding tube incorrectly into her lungs instead of her stomach. This health problem resulted because we were not allowed a G-tube to be placed directly in her stomach and were forced to feed her through a tube down her nose. Sarah was on a ventilator and was having trouble coming off of it after this. Another doctor was hired by the hospital after our doctor was removed, unknown to us at first. He said that he was hired on to take care of things, which we didn't understand at the time what he meant. The new doctor said we should let Sarah die, not to take her, and blamed him for it. He said she will never be a valuable asset to society. He said Sarah wasn't aware of her surroundings and she would never know us, do anything, that our marriage would fail, that it wasn't fair to our other children to burden them with her. We told the doctor that we loved our daughter very much and regardless of her handicap that we wanted her with us, so she was checked, but again with much resistance. So many lies were told and so many horrible things were done to her while at the hospital. We caught the hospital starving our daughter and confronted them on it. She'd been losing weight each week and they blamed it on her being a trisomy 18 child. My husband and I decided to count how many breast milk bottles were really being given, which was 2 bottles instead of 5 of what she was supposed to receive. We were also told that we could not receive home care visits from any nurses unless we signed a DNR. That was a lie. We were pressured over and over to sign a DNR while at the hospital. They continually stated that we shouldn't allow her to suffer by providing any surgeries that we knew could help her to thrive. We even had one doctor try to push us into a men's bathroom to warn us that they were trying to kill our daughter and to get her out of the hospital right away. Another doctor brought us into an x-ray room on his off day to talk with us in private about what was really going on. I was told that the doctors vote each day on who is going to live and who is going to die. This is only a handful of the horrors that we encountered with our daughter. When we first brought her home after a year, she didn't weigh much more than when she was born, 4 pounds, 10 ounces. It was amazing that within 3 months of being at home with a family that loved her, that she gained weight and was thriving and happy. Sarah is now 6 years old. She's thriving, full of joy, and is the love of our lives. Her sisters and brothers adore her. She is not any daily pain like they said she would be. She loves music along with lights and sounds. We know her favorite movie is The Little Mermaid. She can push button switches that the school brings out to make her toys play. She's always happy and very rarely cries. She is growing, although these children grow slowly. Her health has been good, and she hasn't required any regular medications except antibiotics when ill. We are so blessed to have Sarah in our family. She is a joy, not a burden. I believe that all families have the right to proper health care for their children, regardless of their affliction, and parents or families should be the ultimate decision makers of what care is received. Our children should be treated the same as normal, healthy children and given the same options for proper health care. Parents have a right to know when a hospital has a futility of care policy so that they know how to be an advocate for their child before they bring their child to that hospital. In conclusion, I want to say that this bill will give parents the right to know if a hospital has a futility policy and what it is. Although my testimony was about a disabled child, I do have a testimony about a healthy, active teenager, my son, Jeremy. I believe hospital futility policies should be a concern for all of us, and we have a right to know they exist, whether we have children with special needs or not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Sterling.
I pray that this bill is passed.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I'm over here. Hi.
Hi.
You know, it's a pretty shocking story, and I'm just wondering, did you file any lawsuits? Did you complain to the police? I mean, these are really horrible things you're describing. You know, did you make a complaint to the medical board about any of these doctors or anything like that?
Ms. Drillin.
Yes, when various things have happened with our daughter, we have complained to the medical profession, but to my knowledge, nothing has been done. I was told by several attorneys that it was futile for us to try to do any type of lawsuits or complaints because of our daughter's particular condition. The hospital would just argue, well, what is her quality of life anyway compared to the things that they did to her, you know, so no.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, if my child was in the hospital and some doctor said the hospital is trying to kill your child, I mean, I think I'd probably go to the police, you know. But it's interesting to me your response that it was that a lawyer told you or lawyers told you it'd be futile to sue. But when doctors tell you it's futile to take care of your child, you don't believe them. But when a lawyer tells you it's futile to sue, you just kind of take their answer. Seriously, I think if this was happening to me, I think I would pursue all avenues of complaint because these sound like really terrible behaviors.
Ms. Sterling?
Unfortunately, when you have attorneys, it takes money. And I'm a mother of 9 children. And my other testimony in regards to my son, Jeremy, he was in a motorcycle accident on life support in a coma. He was not a disabled child, and they wanted to kill him at 9 days as well. And I had to go down to the courts to get joint legal custody to be able to make them take care of my son, who actually walked out of the hospital a month later, eating, drinking, walking, and talking, and they said he would not do any of that. So it happens at all ages, not just children. But like I say, I'm a mother of 9, having had 9 children, it takes a lot of money to hire attorneys, and I don't have that.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Sterling, for your testimony. Marta McClanahan. Ms. McClanahan, welcome to the committee. Perhaps you can introduce your special guest as well.
This is Caden. I'm Marta McClanahan, sorry. We're from Baxter, Minnesota. And Caden has trisomy 18, and full trisomy 18 is going to be 11 years old in June. And he's a happy boy.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak here today. I'm a mother of a 10-year-old boy named Caden who has trisomy 18. I believe that if my son's hospital is going to have this futility of care policy in place, I should have the right to know the hospital policy before I take my son there. Then I truly have the freedom of choice to be able to find doctors who are willing to care for my son. It has been some time since he has been in the hospital, but when he is, I'm so afraid of leaving him alone for even a minute because I don't have trust that my son will be cared for in the way I would want him to be, safely and fairly. I have had doctors make comments to me over the years that have justified that broken trust. When my son was born, I was told he had malrotation of the bowels and intestines and that if we did not correct it, this would cause a painful death. Then in the same breath, the doctor suggested that because my son had trisomy 18, we shouldn't correct it. This was and is very alarming to me that they could suggest allowing my son or any other child to die a painful death just because he has trisomy 18. Parents need to know where their medical team stands and should know up front if there will be a disconnect between what they want for their child and what the medical team's expectations are. Unlike a true end-of-life scenario where there may be fewer questions about recovery and quality of life, doctors cannot know the outcome of infants born with congenital disorders and defects. If the parents want to employ all of the medical opportunities available, they should have that right. And for older children in the same category that are faced with surgeries or medical treatment, the parents should not have to worry about covert policies that could result in the untimely death of their child. We know there is no cure for such thing for things such as trisomy 18, but people live happy and love-filled lives all the time with incurable medical conditions that are treated, helping them to live much longer. All we ask is that our children be offered treatment like any other child would be, and that we know upfront any policies that would make that not possible. Doctors should not be able to pick and choose who they will and will not treat based on their own beliefs and financial cost. I also had a doctor try to keep pushing us to sign a DNR for my son because he started to have seizures. He only had them once in a while, and they were later found to be able to be controlled with meds. He hasn't had one in 2 years. Parents are the best ones to decide their child's care. I even had a doctor tell me many times that us trisomy 18 moms needed to stop talking to each other because we had such a strong connection and helped each other. My son is amazing and has touched so many lives. He is a valuable part of our family who is not a burden to us. He is a gift and we love him so very much and would be heartbroken and lost without him. My son is not in pain, does not suffer, and is everything I was told he would not be. Caden can sign mom and dad, say mama, go on rides, has been to the ocean, rode horse, and plays with his siblings, and most of all, he can receive and show us love. He is our child. Please let us make choices for his care as his parents. All we want for my son is, and others like him, is to be given a chance and looked at as any other child. I'm asking for you to pass this futility for care bill because it's the fair thing to do. Everyone should know up front what the hospital's policy for children like ours is. We should not be left in the dark. I ask you, does my son look like somebody who's not compatible with life? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. McClanahan, and thank you to Caden as well. Members, any questions to the testifier? Seeing none, we'll move to our next testifier. Jane Montoya. And then if Helen O'Brien can be ready to come up too as soon as we're done with Ms. Montoya's testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your full name for the record and who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jane Montoya, and I live in Minnetonka. Good morning, and thank you for hearing my testimony. I have a 16-year-old daughter with special needs. Her name is Natalia, and she has a rare metabolic disorder called congenital disorder of glycosylation. It affects her nervous system, blood, muscles, heart, digestion, bones, and every other system that uses glycoproteins. Despite her many disabilities, she has a very high quality of life and is very happy. She receives no major or intensive ongoing medical interventions other than that she gets most of her nutrition through a G-tube. I want to share with you a situation where I suspect a futility of care policy may have affected her treatment or lack of treatment. One day when she was about 8 or 9 years old, she lost consciousness, and we assumed that it was a seizure because she had had a few seizures when she was younger. We took her to the hospital when the seizure-stopping medicine we gave her did not work, and she remained unconscious. When we explained to the ER staff the situation, they also assumed it was a seizure and gave her additional sedating medicines, believing this would help to stop what we thought was a seizure. After a few hours of unconsciousness, as her core body temperature was dropping, her heart and respiration were slowing, probably due to the high levels of sedating medicines she was given to stop the non-existent seizure, we were put in a room, left alone, and told there was nothing else they could do. After all the heavy sedating medicines began to wear off, Natalia's vital signs began to improve, and she spontaneously regained consciousness a few hours later. We were sent home in the morning, not really understanding what had happened. It was sometime later, because of a different misdiagnosis, that we by accident learned that these episodes of unconsciousness, of which now she had had a few, were actually low blood sugar. A low blood sugar coma is easily treated with a bit of honey on the tongue. We also learned how to prevent these episodes by simply making sure her feedings are not too far apart and that she doesn't eat too much sugar. Looking back, I wonder if the fact that they gave up so quickly on trying to diagnose the episode had anything to do with the futility of care policy. Natalia's problem was so simple, and yet she was, it was not discovered that night in the hospital when she had was almost sedated to death. I believe that if she were a typical child, there may have been more effort to diagnose the problem and more careful monitoring as she was given repeated doses of sedation without verifying that there was actual seizure activity taking place. I can tell you with utter sincerity that the world would be worse off with this if this child were not in it. She is not only a blessing for our family, but for many others as well. Everyone who knows her is better for having known her. Many people have shared with me how Natalia has changed their lives and inspired them. I'll give you just one quick example. One Sunday morning after church, a gentleman I barely knew came up to me to tell me how much my daughter Natalia had meant to him. I didn't know it at the time, but years later I learned that he was a recovering alcoholic who was going through bankruptcy at the time. He said that when he sees her at church in her wheelchair, propelling herself around with her weak little arms, or struggling to take off her own coat with a smile of satisfaction on her face, it gives him courage to face his own problems and to keep on trying. He said that if she can face all her many challenges with a smile, then he can face his challenges too. This is only one example of the many lives she has touched. As a parent of this extraordinary child, I believe it is only right that I should have access to the futility of care policies of any hospital that may be caring for her. Hospitals should not be allowed to hide this information from patients and their families. At the time of the incident I related, it never crossed my mind that doctors in a hospital would simply decide not to offer appropriate medical care because they didn't see the value in my daughter's life. I now realize that I would have handled that night differently had I known that there was such a thing as a futility of care policy. I am clearly aware that there are times when these tough decisions need to be addressed. I am only saying that as a parent who cares for and knows my child best, I should be involved in these health care decisions and have access to the policies that guide the hospital staff in these decisions. Furthermore, it is clear that no one is immune from being affected by these policies. As we all know, one car accident or brain tumor or other traumatic event could place any one of us or our children in a situation where tough decisions need to be made about our care. Wouldn't we want our families to know on what basis these life and death decisions were being made? Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Montoya. Members, Representative Barrett, I'm going to apologize in advance. We're going to break before the next testifier. Because we are moving back and forth among several committees right now, we wanted a chance to speak briefly to the Autism Task Force report. So we're going to take just a break to hear from Representative Mack on that, and then we will go back to our list of testifiers and continue discussion on the bill. So with apologies to the remaining testifiers and to Representative Barrett, I think we'll do that right now. Representative Mack, if you want to do it from right here? Okay, very good.
If that's okay with you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, I intend to be very brief, and thank you for being gracious and letting me just let you all know about this report that's in your packet, members, on the Autism Spectrum Disorder Task Force. I had the privilege of being a part of that task force for the past 2 years and was recently appointed to the new task force that is just starting up for the next 2 years. Members, some of you may have remembered, I believe the first task force was put together about four years ago now, and the point of this task force is spelled out in the beginning of the report here, but one of the main tasks is to try to figure out how we can better equip families who are dealing with autism when they get that diagnosis, helping to get them the education and the resources that they need so that they know where to turn. As we've talked about in this committee thus far, I believe we talked about it a bit last week, obviously the diagnosis of autism is incredibly daunting for families, but on top of that, members, it is right now very convoluted and difficult for families to know where they can access services, understanding what role the schools play, what role the medical professionals play, and then what other organizations are out there there to come alongside. And so one of the roles of the task force is to try to put together some sort of a statewide plan, some sort of a resource, trying to work with the departments, Department of Education, Department of Health, DHS, DEED, all the different departments that may have a finger on this issue, try to get better coordination so that when families are looking for the help that they need, there's a little bit more of a roadmap in to which they can access what services with which department and where. There's also some recommendations in here from the task force members on run through a couple of them. Creating a guidebook for ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorder, the guidebook I was referring to, that would allow parents to know what services are available. Part of the challenge with autism is knowing what treatment is going to be best for your child. It certainly is not a one-size-fits-all type of a program, type of a diagnosis. And so trying to compile the wealth of information that's out there that other states have put together. Many states have these guidebooks available for their citizens, and looking for Minnesota to put something together similar to that. Members, it's in front of you, so you can read through it. I would be happy to be a resource. Representative Nora Slawick was also on the committee with me. I know that she would love to be a resource. She's actually served on it for the last two task force now, so she has even a little bit more experience. But would be happy to take any questions now. Otherwise, members, I encourage you to take a look at this. Might help you be a better resource to your constituents in the future. And if you have any questions about what we're working on going forward, don't hesitate to ask, and you'd all be welcome to come and testify or be a part of the task force as we move forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the time.
Representative Mack, thank you for your leadership on this, as well as Representative Slawick's leadership on this. A very comprehensive set of recommendations from the task force. Representative Norton.
Thank you. And could you tell us how often the committee meets, when it meets, and is it open to the public?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Norton, it is open to the public, most definitely. I believe the meetings, we've just kind of been setting up the meetings, I believe they are going to be, and I can clarify this information, but the second Tuesday of the month, and they will alternate morning meetings at 9 o'clock and evening meetings at 6 o'clock. To allow hopefully parents and folks to participate, whether evenings or mornings work better. So at this point, it will be once a month for the next year.
Great. Thank you for asking that, Representative Norton. Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is very important work, and there are a lot of needs that continue to be met. However, the task force is focused in on children, those to age 21, and there's not a lot of aid or help after that. And Representative Norton and I were lucky to join a group, and Representative Liebling in Rochester recently, about the needs of high-functioning autistic individuals after the age of 21. Unfortunately, ran out of time in terms of getting it heard in the Commerce Committee, but I have a bill. Hopefully it will be heard next year, and possibly we'd bring it here to just flesh out any additional details. But about the help that they need, especially with high-functioning autistic people, with just the counseling that would continue to keep them employed. But thank you for your work on the committee.
Good. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mack, thank you for your work on this, and I'm really glad this is ongoing. This is a huge issue for us, but since we're sitting here hearing a bill about futility policies, I'm just wondering, did that ever come up among parents of autistic kids? Is there anything here about so-called futility policies?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling. Representative Liebling, I do not recall that specific issue coming up. There were a couple of meetings that I did not make, and so there's a chance that I missed it. But to my knowledge, that has not come up. But it's certainly something I will take note of, and would imagine it would be a worthy conversation to have with the folks in that room, because we have parents that attend frequently, and I would imagine it's something that's of great interest to them.
Members, any other questions or comments? Again, thank you to Representative Mack and the entire task force for bringing this forward, and would encourage people to read it. I'm sure there will be legislation coming out of this at some future point. With that, Representative Barrett, we will go back to testimony on your bill, and I believe the next person on the list is Helen O'Brien. with Gillette Children's Hospital. Ms. O'Brien, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, who you represent, and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, parents, my name is Helen Wells O'Brien. I am an ordained pastor in the Mennonite Church USA and serve as a staff chaplain at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. In my ministry at Gillette Children's, I am a member of the Gillette Ethics Committee, have been a member for quite a number of years, and am often involved in consulting and working with doctors, other healthcare professionals, and family members, especially parents, as they struggle with very difficult, challenging, and often painful issues in medical decision making, some of which you've heard today. Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare provides specialized healthcare for children, teens, and adults living with short-term and long-term disabilities that began in childhood. Many of our patients are medically fragile, and they live with lifelong complex disabilities and also amazing abilities. For our pediatric patients, parents are, of course, most often the primary decision makers about medical treatments and goals of care. The question of medical futility, even in such a complex healthcare environment, comes up rarely in my experience because patients, families, and healthcare providers work hard to communicate with one another and to talk about appropriate medical care for each and every patient. At Gillette, it has sometimes, in fact, been parents who question the benefit of certain aggressive medical treatments. It has been parents who have raised the question about whether interventions might be harmful or even futile to their child's care. Parents must weigh the burdens and benefits of any medical treatment, and they must do so in light of whether or not they believe their child is suffering from those treatments, the quality of their child's living, and their deeply held beliefs and values. Our policy at Gillette that addresses what might be regarded as burdensome, harmful, or futile treatments is, in fact, a dispute resolution process, only to be used when those involved in a child's care disagree about whether a medical intervention is harmful, non-beneficial, or futile for a particular patient. Gillette's policy is based on a model policy, and this relates to a question that one of the representatives had before this. That model policy became available in August of 2008. The model policy, which was entitled the Model Policy for Medical Interventions Considered to Be Harmful, Non-Beneficial, or Futile, Decision-Making and Dispute Resolution, was written by a task force appointed by a group representing the Center for Bioethics at the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota Center for Healthcare Ethics, and many ethics committees of Minnesota healthcare organizations. It was a very public task force, and it was charged with developing a community standard for a dispute resolution process to be used when medical treatments or interventions were believed by patients, by families, or by medical staff to be harmful, non-beneficial, or futile for a particular patient. This model policy has been used as a community standard to draft dispute resolution policies governing harmful treatments in many Twin Cities hospitals and major healthcare organizations like Gillette. Early in 2009, the Gillette Ethics Committee began to study this model policy on dispute resolution developed by that task force. I want you to know that the Gillette Ethics Committee is composed of patient representatives, parent representatives, members at large from the community that do not work at Gillette, and also, of course, interdisciplinary members of the healthcare team, physicians, nurses, social workers, chaplaincy, as well as representatives from administration and human resources. Our policy at Gillette provides for the policy to be shared with a family as soon as any disagreement arises about the benefit or burden of medical treatment. It supports and provides a careful and structured conversation facilitated by a member of the ethics committee between loved ones and the healthcare team so that we stop having these kind of hurtful kinds of conversations that families were testifying about, and we come in and have a structured conversation facilitated by somebody trained to do that. The policy requires a second medical opinion. It provides for transferring a patient to another facility if loved ones believe that that would be best for their loved one. And to this point, we have always reached agreement using this transparent process and have never used the full dispute resolution process because agreement was realized at an earlier point. Most importantly, as a part of our ongoing care for patients, even in situations of disagreement or in cases when aggressive medical treatments are limited, the top priority is always the physical, spiritual, and emotional comfort of patients and their loved ones. Our policy structures the process by which disputes regarding benefit, burden, or futility of medical interventions can be discussed openly, hopefully transparently, and consistently by patients, families, and healthcare professionals. Our policy highly values achieving a resolution of those disputes through careful discussion, through listening to one another, through negotiation, and through deciding what is in the best interest of a particular patient. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members and parents.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, we have a few who have questions. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't sure I wanted to talk on this, and I really appreciate the testimony that you gave, and in no way do I want to question the experiences of the individuals who were here before, but you raised a point that I guess I wanted to offer as a counterbalance to this, and I worked for a number of years in the area of birth to three special needs. I often would work with families who had received a diagnosis, sometimes quite dramatic diagnoses while in the hospital, and had contact with those parents. I also experienced, and some have good experiences, positive ones, some I'm sure had less positive ones, but I also experienced times when it was the parent who would look at me in the eyes and say, why are you trying to provide services for my child? So sometimes it is a parent of a child who questions the services that are being provided. And I did, while it is rare, I did want to offer that counterbalance. This is not a one-way situation. There are parents who hand their children over at a few days old, a few weeks old, or a few months old to foster care because they don't understand the quality of life issue or why anyone would provide services, nor were they interested in providing service for that child. So it's a very difficult issue. I guess I haven't thought through enough about what your bill, and it looks like it is information only, at least on this side, the full outcome of that is. It sounds like Gillette has a wonderful process and some significant due process for families to intervene, and I want to encourage the parents here. It's probably too late for many of them to file charges or complaints, but the MMA has a board where doctors, you should complain when someone tells you that your child doesn't deserve or they don't want to provide a service. I think there is a process for that. It doesn't necessarily have to be a lawyer in a lawsuit, but I would encourage families, and I would encourage you to encourage other people that you talk to make certain that Board of Medical Practice. I have a little elf in my ear that the complaint should be filed with. But I did just want to provide that balance, as was pointed out in the testimony. Sometimes it's the parent who doesn't want to provide the service. Sometimes it is the hospital that doesn't want to provide service, and strong policies that allow both of those people to have a very strong conversation, a respectful conversation, to do what's best in the best comfort and interest of the child is recommended.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Norton. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Ms. O'Brien, I'd certainly appreciate a copy of your testimony. If I could have a copy of that, I'll give you my card afterwards. I found it very informative of what the current status is and why. But I'd like to make an observation and then you comment on it. I've been part of I've sold health insurance since 1978. I know nurses and doctors, and this is a difficult area, so I want to choose my words carefully, okay? Number one, I just had a conversation on Monday morning with one of my clients who is a head nurse at a local hospital, and, you know, the futility policy has been around a long time, and I can understand that. You know, we said hundreds or thousands of years, and according to this head nurse that I talked to, you know, especially with some elderly she talked about, there'll be relatives who make unreasonable demands for certain types of medical treatment, which is futile according to current medical practice, okay? So I can understand that we need some type of policy like that in force, because demands of relatives can sometimes be unrestrained. You know, from my standpoint, the futility policy worked well when the medical profession had a strong commitment to the Hippocratic Oath, a belief in the sanctity of life. When they had those three characteristics, the futility policy worked well, because we had doctors saying, my first priority is to do no harm. I think all of us need to realize that in recent years, the underlying philosophy in medical care is changing from the Hippocratic Oath and the sanctity of life to a utilitarian worldview of medical practice. And what I mean by that, before it was human life first and cost second. Today we're moving towards cost first and human life second. And the Hippocratic Oath is being replaced by utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is not based on the sanctity of life, it is based on the fraudulent theory of social Darwinism. It's tied closely to the abortion mentality, which is coming out of the womb into our medical facilities. I guess I'd like to have you respond to that, and if you see this new philosophy seeping into our medical community, and it'll be even further expanded by the so-called Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, which is going to take this utilitarian view and drive it home even further.
Well, Representative Goodhanger, I'm going to allow Ms. O'Brien to respond, but that's a pretty large... We might have any number of people in the room here might have a desire to respond to that in various forms, but Ms. O'Brien.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I cannot address all of that. I want to say that I believe the Hippocratic Oath is alive and well in most physicians. There is a strong covenant that physicians enter into to do no harm. And the times that I have, in my experience, seen physicians struggle with treatments for patients, it is around this question: am I doing harm to my patient? I think that we have to have that. We need that basic trust that the Hippocratic Oath is alive and well. I also want to stress that it is highly unethical in any bioethical setting, in any hospital, long-term care facility, in any medical facility, to consider finances when one is considering a patient's best interest. Families and loved ones have the right to take their own finances under consideration, but it is unethical, and there are ethical statements in every state and in the United States that make that very clear. That would be a clear violation of a patient's rights.
Ms. Gare, one follow-up comment.
Representative Grenhagen, then there's a couple other people who'd like to weigh in on this conversation.
Just, you know, we need to move from why, you know, whether we should treat this patient or not to the question of why does it have to cost so much? And when you follow that question of cost, it leads you to government subsidies, government mandates, government regulations, and the trial lawyers in this country. That's where it leads.
Okay, Representative Leland, we're taking you out of turn because I think you want to comment on this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that the testifier kind of responded with part of what I wanted to say, and that is, Representative Grenhagen, you do need to watch what you say, because I frankly feel resentful of the accusation against the medical profession, and as you know, I'm married to a physician, and I represent a district with many physicians and a very large medical center whose motto is, the needs of the patient come first, and lives by that motto. And so I very much resent this implication that somehow ethics have changed and people only now care about cost. But I do want to point out one thing to you that is changing, and that is our ability to intervene has changed. That there are things available now to intervene with, for example, some of the heart-wrenching stories that we heard. You know, some years ago, we wouldn't have been able to do anything for these children. So the fact that children now can be saved at younger ages, that we can even, through a newborn screening, diagnose and intervene to actually prevent a lot of medical issues and let children lead absolutely normal lives that they wouldn't have been able to lead, I mean, that's what's changing. And that there are many, many things available that never would have been available on both ends of life and in between, anywhere in between. But these things do cost money. So unless you're willing to say everyone should get everything, then there is, in fact, some need to make some decisions in society. And you even referred to that yourself, that at the end of life, who's to say that something is futile or not futile? These are very difficult questions. So I just wanted to speak to that, to say that I frankly resent the implication that physicians as a whole are anything less than there to care for their patients, notwithstanding that, of course, there are always some bad actors, and there are people who have a bad day, and there are people who step over the line, just like we sometimes do here at the legislature.
Mr. Chair, one quick response.
Representative Grenhagen.
I didn't say that all physicians as a whole. I said it's a philosophy that is seeping into the medical care area, and more people seem to be buying into it. And my strong concern is that the Unaffordable Care Act is going to drive this utilitarian view even further into the medical community. And again, we need to ask, why does it have to cost this much? Okay, rather than, yes, these things are available, but why does it have to cost so much? Follow that reasoning or that question to its answer, and you're going to run into a lot of government as the problem.
Representative Benson.
I'm sorry, but I didn't raise my hand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh!
You don't want to weigh in.
Representative Barrett, I know you had some comments to kind of wrap up the presentation on this bill.
Sure, Mr. Chair. If I could pass out a document, I should have done this earlier, but I really want to wait until all the folks who came to testify and tell their personal stories, because I think the information I have here might summarize and quantify. Unfortunately, I have that bad habit to want to do some of the real life stories that we heard today. And this is a real issue. It's a very important issue. And I think it's supported by a lot of the facts that are out there. I came across this document actually only last night, and just trying to understand the issue as much as I could and try to articulate the message as clearly as I possibly could. It's a study that was done over a 10-year period. This particular report came out July of 2011, and it's got some fairly interesting thoughts in it. I think some people could look at it one way and other people could look at it another way, but if I could just hit some highlights to share with the members here. And that is starting with the headline, Medical Futility Trend Seen in Neonatal Deaths. Neonatal infants younger than 28 days old account for the majority of childhood deaths in the United States, according to this study. Down a couple paragraphs, in order to find out if such trends are continuing, Dr. Julie Weiner of Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City and colleagues examined the medical records of 414 infants who died between January 99 and December of 08. The next paragraph, 45% of the infants who died had major birth defects. 17% of those infants were also very preterm. I don't know what the ratio is of children born with birth defects compared to those that have died neonatally with birth defects, but I imagine 45% in my mind is an alarming number. And so the question I ask is why? We have stories here of a lot of children who have birth defects, trisomy 18 and 21. I became aware of this issue a couple years ago at a Prenatal Partners for Life conference in which I had no idea about this subject at all. And I understood or thought that Down syndrome babies, from whatever community, there's some understanding that could not live. They can. And so the fact that 45% of infants with major birth defects were part of a 414 infants who died is alarming. The researchers found that 61.6% of infant deaths followed withdrawal of treatment, 20.8% followed withholding of treatment, and 17.6% died despite attempted cardiopulmonary resuscitation. The next paragraph, and I'll end with this, is that over a 10-year study period, the number of deaths that occurred after withholding of treatment increased by an average of 1.03 deaths. This is the number of deaths that occurred after withholding treatment. Among very preterm infants, deaths following withholding of treatment increased from less than 10% to more than 30%. This is an issue, and it's happening all throughout our country, and it's an issue that I think all we're asking for is information. And parents have the understanding of what the policy is at that hospital when they take their child to that hospital to be cared for.
Very good. Representative Barrett, I want to thank you for presenting this bill. I would say that the point behind Representative Grinhagen's comments isn't an invalid one, and that's to ask to what extent are financial issues playing a role in health care. That's a question we can always be asking. Without castigating anybody in particular, but it's a question worth asking from time to time. I also want to thank the testifiers. I know this is a very sensitive issue, and I want to thank you for your testimony and for telling your stories here today. Members, with that, and having no other business before the committee. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. What am I thinking here? This is our last time together as a committee, and so. I want to thank a number of people. Our staff is outstanding, by the way. I have to thank and have an extreme bias towards these two individuals on my right and my left. Shirley Cotterick is awesome. I tell her that all the time. And those of you who've run committees before, Representative Huntley, know how important these people are. In making sure that things go well and smoothly. And so Shirley, you've done a fabulous job. Holly Everson, our committee administrator, did a fantastic job as well and kept me straight and kept all the issues in line. Unbelievable the work these people do when we're not around even. Research, we have Lucy Morgan, DFL Research. Pat LeBeco is our GOP research guy and getting married soon. And I'd be remiss if I didn't thank our House research people, Emily Cleveland, Randy Chun, Lynn Aves, and Danielle Pinelli. So let's give them... We're getting there. We're getting there. Representative Norton is eager to get to the pages. So Leslie Thompson has been our committee page, very faithful, hardworking. Thank you, Leslie. And there have been other pages who've helped us out, too. Representative Hosh, I see, is here. Very good. Now, that's a shot. Is there a camera, a house camera person in the...
Anybody know a photographer?
He's a, yeah, there yeah. you go. Representative McDonald maybe has his camera with him. But I do want to say I think the policy committee dealt with some very important issues this session. We had some very good hearings on some very tough issues, and I want to thank members of on both sides, Democrats as well as Republicans. We've done some good work, I think, and there's more work yet to do before we leave this place, but I want to thank all of you for your fine work and contributions to the work of this committee. Representative Huntley.
Oh, Mr. Chair and members, I don't think the public really understands how much work our staff people do. And, you know, we get done here and we go home, and they're still here working late into the early mornings. And sometimes I get emails from some of them, and, yeah. and I don't think they've cheated with their computer. But I look at the times that they're still working, and it's amazing.
No, that's absolutely true. I think they deserve another round of applause.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion. We thank the chair of the committee.
Oh, no. No, no. I mean, we get the opportunity to carry the gavel, and we... Yeah, I hear no second. I think that needs to be seconded, and there wasn't any, so we'll move past that. No, it has been it's been a distinct honor, so thank you all. With that, our committee is adjourned.